an Orlando veteran fired twice from one government job.
It's a bit humiliating, honestly, at first, to share with family and friends, like, hey, this happened again, I was fired.
You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Sharon Stone. Also coming up, planned education department layoffs in its special education division are creating challenges for families of students with unique abilities here. And Special Olympics Florida is recruiting the next generation of coaches. We'll talk to a local gold medal team where passion, not a playbook, is the key to victory. But first, being terminated while on furlough because of the government shutdown. Doug Jackson is a disabled Marine veteran of the Iraq War and an IRS employee based in Orlando. He's one of 47,000 Central Florida workers impacted by the government shutdown that started October 1st. Right now, he's on furlough without pay. In previous shutdowns, furloughed federal workers were guaranteed back pay once the government reopened. This time, Jackson doesn't know if that will happen. The Office of Management and Budget published guidance stating that back pay is not guaranteed. When Jackson opened his personal email Friday, he saw the Reduction in Force, or RIF, letter from the Department of Treasury saying his position is being eliminated effective December 9th. He says about a dozen of his team members who are spread across the country received a similar notice. Jackson and I spoke on Tuesday, the day before a judge on Wednesday temporarily blocked the Trump administration from firing federal workers during the shutdown. The appeals and court battles continue over the president's authority to remove federal workers and whether the layoffs will be allowed. For Jackson, this is his second time being terminated from this exact job this year. He was fired at the beginning of the year by Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency during cuts to reduce the size of the federal workforce. Jackson says he was rehired several weeks later. Today, he's looking for a job again, uncertain about his future. Jackson says he had a sick feeling when the government did shut down that this would happen.
So last Friday, about a week into the government shutdown, I saw a tweet by OMB, Office of Management and Budget Director, Russell Voigt, saying essentially that the RIFs have begun. That was around 12:30 or so Friday afternoon. And about 2 hours later, I got an email to my personal email with the PDF. And it was a copy of my reduction in force, my RIF letter, letting me know that I was essentially being separated from the IRS and that it would be effective 60 days from that date. So December 6th, it'll be effective.
You are currently on furlough.
Yes, along with all the other federal workers who are not considered essential, like DHS, military, TSA, everyone else who is not deemed essential is furloughed and legally not allowed to work.
So the only reason you found out is because you saw it go to your personal email because you're not even really supposed to be checking your work email on furlough.
Correct. And other members of my team, for whatever reason, did not receive a letter to their personal email. I can see, you know, in the email that it went to my work email and my personal, but it was kind of mixed between who got the letter and who didn't because we're not logged on to our work computer to see the letter.
So when you open up your email and see this letter, what's your reaction?
Not terribly surprised, honestly. Similar to the Doge firing in January, I wasn't really surprised then, and I wasn't surprised now. I kind of had a sick feeling when the government did shut down because the administration had been threatening to do this. They've been threatening to use, I quote, Democrat-caused shutdown to fire, quote, Democrat-oriented workers. And so I thought it was inevitable that they were going to use the shutdown as a way to fire a bunch of people.
You don't meet a lot of people that have been fired from the same job twice in a year. What was it like going back the first time? Did you go back thinking this was going to be temporary or you needed a backup plan? Or were you at any point hopeful this was going to be okay?
Yes. So initially, when I was fired in January because of the Doge cuts, something told me because it was so brazen, I thought, okay, there's a decent chance here that we'll get our jobs back because it was so indiscriminate. And, you know, thankfully, unions and other parties petitioned, filed lawsuits on our behalf, and the courts ruled that the firings were illegal. And so we were ultimately rehired about 2 months later. And so when I returned, you know, there was relief, of course, and it was good to be working with everyone again and sort of pick back up where I left off, which is really just orientation. I had just started. I had been on the job for 2 weeks when I was fired the first time. And so really just kind of picking up where I left off and getting situated in my job function. And so having gone through that the first time, I wasn't taking too much for granted. I hope. I thought there was a decent chance that it could happen again. And there's been many other things that have happened in the meantime. There have been people who have been encouraged or have been offered to take a DRP, which is the deferred either resignation program or deferred retirement program. I can't remember what it stands for. But basically, since then, the IRS workforce have been reduced by 20%. That's my understanding.
Where's your head at now? Do you even want to go back?
Yes and no. Part of me has been determined and defiant to not let them push me out or become so miserable or kind of jaded by this experience that I just wash my hands of and say, oh yeah, you know, they're right. This has become such a miserable experience that I'll remove myself. I'll just leave, even if I am offered the job again, because I think it's important for the American people and the administration to see that federal workers are resilient and they're determined and committed to the job that they were doing before all of this happened. And most people aren't aware, but people that are federal workers work in civil service on average are making 25% less than their peers in the private sector. And so there is an inherent pay cut in working for the government, but many of us have worn the uniform and are drawn towards public service and want to take the oath of office once again to uphold and defend the Constitution by serving the public in federal service. All that to say, I would love to continue serving as a federal worker. I'm not sure if that'll even be an option this time, but realistically, I do have to keep my options open and just know that I may have to pivot and do something else if this sort of thing continues.
How do you talk to your family, your wife, about this? How does this impact your family?
It's a tough conversation to have with family because you don't really want pity. You don't want people to feel sorry for you. And you don't want them to be overly concerned, but you do want to keep them informed and keep them up to date on how things are going in your life, or, you know, why you may not be able to travel this Thanksgiving or Christmas because, you know, you need to do the smart thing. You need to kind of put everything on hold. And so it's a bit humiliating, honestly, at first to share with family and friends, like, hey, this happened again. I was fired. I mean, no one likes to say that. And everyone, of course, who knows me understands this isn't based off of my performance. It's completely indiscriminate. I'm caught up in this broader trend and this wave of other people just like me being terminated from the federal government. But, you know, it's discouraging and I don't like having to tell people about it. But at the same time, I feel an obligation because there's a lot of people that won't say anything who maybe don't have a close support network of family and friends and will just sort of suffer in silence. And so I think it's important for someone like me, not only for my own personal interest to share with family and friends, but to also just share with others, to let people know it's not just DC bureaucrats. It's not just DEI hires. It's not people who are poor performers who are being let go. It's completely indiscriminate.
But you're a veteran, a service disabled veteran. Did you think that would come with some type of protection in terms of being able to keep your job?
Yes, and it's not just implied, it's actually codified. Every federal worker has a personal document called an SF-50, which includes a code, essentially their RIF protection code, or where they would rank if a RIF were to happen. It's sort of a tiered system based off of longevity in the federal government, your performance, whether you're a veteran or not, whether you're a service-disabled veteran. And service-disabled veterans have the highest RIF protection of anyone in the federal government. They should be the absolute last people legally that you're able to fire. And so you kind of have to pick from the top of the stack, an inverted pyramid almost, of, you know, poor performers, people who haven't been there for very long. If a RIF happens, those are the people that are let go first. And really the absolute last people that should be let go are high performing service disabled veterans. Yet those are the very people that have been fired. It's not just an assumption or something that's implied or a courtesy that's offered to service disabled veterans. It is codified into law that we should be protected and the last ones affected by what happened on Friday.
And what do you hope comes from all of this? What would a win look like at this point?
I'm sad to say I don't see a win in sight anytime soon. The courts may rule in our favor. And in that regard, I would breathe a sigh of relief and know that a lot of my coworkers are going to have their jobs back, have a sense of stability. It'll be a sigh of relief for their family and friends. But for me personally, I wouldn't feel a sense of vindication if the courts ruled in our favor and we got our jobs back. That's not enough. Because when you sign on to be a federal worker, this is not the experience that you sign up for. You take a 25% pay cut and a lack of all sorts of other benefits that are there in the private sector because for no other reason than you enjoy and you prioritize public service. So even if we were rehired, even if there was an apology, which I don't expect, I'm not sure that there is really a win in sight that would be good enough for me.
Have you started looking for other work and what's next?
I've kept my eyes open since January, and a lot of the jobs that I would be interested in or qualified for, a lot of them have dried up. They're just not there, but it doesn't seem like it's a great job market right now. And so I am looking. I'm not sure how optimistic I am, but I am looking.
Marine veteran Doug Jackson is an IRS employee in Orlando. Thousands of federal employees like Jackson are getting reduction in force termination notices. The Education Department is set to lose hundreds. Staff at the Office of Special Education and Rehabilitative Services are among them, as well as the Education Department's Office for Civil Rights. Those offices investigate discrimination complaints, oversee special education funding, and implement the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. IDEA is a federal law that guarantees those children have access to free, appropriate public education. Public schools and others that receive federal funds are required to provide individualized education programs, or IEPs, and 504 plans. An IEP is customized for a student with special needs and is part of the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. 504 plans accommodate students with disabilities and come from a civil rights law called the Rehabilitation Act. The offices that oversee the programs are being hit by the mass firings at the center of these ongoing legal challenges. Here in Central Florida, Rebecca Saman has experience navigating these plans and programs. She's an occupational therapist in Orlando and the mother of three. Her 18-year-old daughter is a high school senior and has Down syndrome. Her youngest is 16, a junior in public school, and he is on the autism spectrum with learning disabilities. Saman has used both IEPs and 504 plans to support her children. She has concerns about permanent job cuts at the federal level impacting families like hers.
My first reaction was really one of shock. I was surprised to hear how far-reaching the layoffs are, and a lot of concern and honestly a lot of questions. We haven't heard a lot about what the plan is for those employees who are laid off, who's going to have their responsibilities, or how might things change in the Department of Education based on these layoffs. So I would say definitely shock, concern, and questions.
Do you see these changes as something that are creating confusion or perhaps something that could create harm?
I definitely believe there's a lot of confusion surrounding the layoffs, and I think potentially they could be harmful.
For families raising children with special needs or disabilities, these IEP and 504 plans, they can really be a lifeline. And you've navigated these plans as a mother. Can you help us understand just the real world impact of what these plans do?
From my perspective as both a mother and a professional, I think these plans are crucial for kids with special needs and learning differences. The plans help the kids have an equal playing ground to access their curriculum. And sometimes the plans are very robust, and sometimes they're not quite so robust, but that's really dependent on the needs of the student. So in my personal experience, I have children who have had both IEPs and 504 plans, and without those, my kids would not have been successful in school. From everything, considering their academics to their social, emotional skills, their independent functioning, all of the areas that the IEPs have addressed have been essential for my kids.
Do you have concerns that what's happening on the federal level could impact these plans?
I do have concerns about the federal changes that could potentially impact both IEP plans and 504 plans. You know, I'm looking at how IEPs and 504s are run. You know, they're run by the states, but there is a dual responsibility between the states and the federal government to effectively implement these plans. Federal funds help to support the states to being able to implement the plans, but there's also oversight and there's feedback and direction from the federal government to the states. So I'm not sure with these changes what that's going to look like going forward.
Losing that federal oversight, help me understand what a consequence of that could be.
One consequence could be who is keeping the states responsible for meeting their end of their requirements under IDEA and the 504 statutes.
The federal laws aren't changing here. Public schools are required to provide IEPs under the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. They're required to have 504 plans. Am I hearing you say that the concerns are with there's no one keeping the protections in place? If you have a complaint about it, no one's going to hear it.
I think that's where some of the confusion comes in. There still are procedural safeguards in place that parents have at their fingertips that they are able to access whenever they have a complaint. And there are procedures that they can follow when there are issues. However, on a larger scale, the Office of Special Education Programs has directed some information to states in terms of investigating the states when there has been a problem. This is something that we're not sure how going forward it will happen with such a small skeleton staff of employees within those offices at the federal level.
What do you wish that more people in Central Florida understood about what is happening at the federal level and the impacts to children, to students in our community with these unique abilities and special needs?
When it comes to understanding what's going on at the federal level, I think it's very convoluted and it's difficult to find the accurate pieces of information. But I think if we all stay connected and try to consume information to the best of our abilities, I personally am part of a lot of different advocate groups. So that's been very helpful for me to help understand what's going on at the federal level. Just getting educated, I think, is the best way that we can all advocate.
Rebecca, you've been on the board of the Down Syndrome Association of Central Florida and recently rejoined. What made you come back?
I had been out for several years, you know, and I was really just in the thick of it, raising my kids who are very close in age. I've had three teenagers for 3 years now. My oldest is about to turn 20, so I will only have two teenagers. But it just was really busy for us personally and family-wise for many years. But I had always been missing that aspect of giving back, being involved in the community, and advocating on a larger level than just with my own individual children.
Has being the mother of children with unique abilities and special needs change your view of the role of advocacy?
Absolutely. It has. And one thing I've learned is that we can all be part of advocacy. You can do it on a grand scale, but you can also do it on a smaller scale. And it starts with being educated. That's something that I feel very strongly about, is that a lot of these parents out there with children with different needs, different learning needs, they don't always understand the process for creating an IEP or a 504 plan. Or even if they do, their resources are usually spread thin. So I think that being together as a community, helping each other advocate, is something I'm very passionate about. And I'm looking forward to just bringing more advocacy to Central Florida.
Mother of three, Rebecca Saman, serves on the board of the Down Syndrome Association of Central Florida. As the director at IEP Coaching and Advocacy, located in Orlando, Debbie Gelinas works with families every day who are navigating special needs programs and laws she describes as a complex maze. She helps them develop plans to get free, appropriate public education for their children. Gelinas is reminding parents contacting her, worried about federal layoffs, that their students still have protected rights.
It's a timely and serious concern. First, I want to validate parents of students with disabilities because it is serious. The cutoffs could potentially create a real slowdown in the process, particularly in the area of any types of complaints that are filed. It's going to impact the funding that comes from the federal government to the state and local school districts. It's going to just slow down the delivery of services in terms of those types of services that IDEA covers, and that's anything in an individual educational plan. So the services of speech and language, occupational therapy, and the ESE, Exceptional Student Education Instruction piece. So anything that falls under the IEP is going to be impacted. However, what I encourage parents to hold on to is the fact that the laws are not changing.
The federal laws that protect that student's right to the free, appropriate public education simply are not changing.
Right. Correct.
Would you say that the concerns we were talking about, are they about the money actually paying for these services and programs that children are entitled to? Or do you have any concerns about how this could affect access? Will students with special needs and disabilities be able to access those programs we're talking about?
They will be able to access it and continue to have the services delivered. The concerns that we have, of course, is in, you know, when there's lack of funding, there's, you know, the domino's effect is that there's going to be a lack of resources. And Florida already suffers because we have more students than we have teachers. And that's an ongoing struggle, is to even meet the needs as they currently exist. And IDEA funds cover a portion of what students with disabilities require in terms of those resources, and the state picks up the remainder. So we're going to have to go to the local and state, and then when they don't have the resources, that's when we're going to see the trickling down effect, negative effect.
Is there anything that parents or advocates can realistically do now to protect their students' access to free, appropriate public education?
I think the best thing that parents and anyone working in the schools can do is continue to advocate at, you know, with Congress and their senators to get this fixed at the federal level. I think the Trump administration is trying to reorganize and get rid of any unnecessary monies that are not being spent wisely. And while that's a good thing, it's not good to eliminate all of the resources that students with disabilities need in order to receive what the law dictates they have a right to receive, and that is that free, appropriate public education. What parents should be doing is making sure that their students' services are being delivered. And if they are not, they need to be recording and keeping track of missed services.
We've been talking about this a bit. What happens if the people enforcing those laws aren't there anymore in terms of, does it leave enforcement up to the school districts and parents?
So we will proceed with, you know, filing complaints that are investigated by, in Florida, the Florida Department of Education investigates any complaints. That will continue. The right to mediation that parents have will continue. The right to file due process against a school district will continue. You know, as an advocate and working with schools and parents, I totally get both sides. There's, you know, frustration on both sides, the school as well as, you know, the families that are impacted by this. It's not a party for anybody. You know, everybody's being negatively impacted. But at the end of the day, parents have the rights under IDEA to ensure that their students have a free, appropriate public education.
Debbie Gelinas is director at IEP Coaching and Advocacy, located in Orlando, that serves all 50 states. Education Secretary Linda McMahon posted a statement on social media Wednesday saying the shutdown has forced agencies to evaluate what federal responsibilities are critical. I will read you part of that statement now. It says, quote, 2 weeks in, millions of American students are still going to school, teachers are getting paid, and schools are operating as normal. It confirms what the president has said. The federal Department of Education is unnecessary, and we should return education to the states. The department has taken additional steps to better reach American students and families and root out the education bureaucracy that has burdened states and educators with unnecessary oversight. No education funding is impacted by the RIF, including funding for special education, and the Clean CR supported by the Trump administration will provide states and schools the funding they need to support all students, end quote. There's more ahead on Engage. The connection between Wilma and Jacob goes well beyond Special Olympics Florida coach and athlete. They're showing us what it really means to win and sharing their story to inspire the next generation of coaches to join the team. Don't forget to subscribe to the Engage podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify so you don't miss an episode. This is Engage on Central Florida Public Media.
There's a lot going on in space, from efforts to land astronauts on the moon
and liftoff of Artemis 1
to answering the age-old question, are we alone in the universe?
Wouldn't you want to know if there was life on another planet?
Are We There Yet? Explores space exploration every Tuesday at 6:30 here on Central Florida Public Media.
You are listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Sharon Stone. Ahead on the program, a feline fiasco for real.
What's up, everybody? My name is Rafael Terraza, and today we are in here with a UCF kitty contest.
Yeah! We're not kidding around. Hundreds of UCF students channel their inner Garfield, Puss in Boots, or Hello Kitty to earn the honor of Best Meower, Meowing Forever. But first, here on Engage, sometimes a great coach makes all the difference in the outcome. Let me win. But if I cannot win, let me be brave in the attempt. That's the athlete oath written by Eunice Kennedy Shriver, the founder of the Special Olympics. Those games spotlight the abilities of the competitors. Special Olympics Florida has year-round training and competition. They're recruiting the next generation of coaches. Wilma Wright has been a Special Olympics coach for more than a decade. She started a unified volleyball team while working as a physical education coach at a Winter Garden middle school. She admits that she didn't really know what she was doing at first, but with support and training, it worked out. She led the team to gold at the 2022 USA Special Olympics Games in Orlando. Jacob Kraft is an athlete from Orlando. He tells me he competes in 10 different sports. The connection between Jacob and Wilma is more than Special Olympics Florida athlete and coach. It's an unwavering bond built on respect, trust, and hope. Their conversation might inspire new coaches to get involved.
I was teaching middle school, and they had a program at Lakeview Middle, but it had stopped maybe 3 or 4 years before that. And the police liaison came up to me and asked me if I would be interested in starting up Special Olympics. And I said, I will not know what I'm doing. I said, but yeah, sure, I'll do it. And that's when it started. And then it just grew and grew after that. And I loved it. We've done basketball, flag football, bowling, track, back in the beginning days.
And Jacob, tell me about what sport you compete in and what you love most about it.
With Coach Wright, I compete in 3 different sports. I do basketball, volleyball, and flag football with Coach Wright. But in Special Olympics, I compete in 10 sports, if I'm correct. It's basketball, volleyball, golf. I did swimming, flag football, stand-up paddleboarding, and then there's another one, but I can't remember what it is.
Wilma, what's the bond like between you and an athlete like Jacob?
I just feel like he's my son. I am so close with him because I got to meet him when he was in middle school, and I've seen him grow as a person, and he's become a fine young man. And I've just really enjoyed watching his journey to where he is now. But yeah, I kind of feel like he's my kid. So,
Jacob, what does Coach Wright mean to you?
Like Coach Wright said, even though we're not blood related, we're still family. I've been with Coach Wright for a long time. My family loves her, and I'm excited to see what our journey still entails.
Jacob, how does a coach help you in your competitions in achieving your goals?
With Coach Wright, we always know if we're down, we can go talk to her. And they're always there to show us like what's the best way to compete at that level.
Coach Wright, for our audience who may not be familiar with Special Olympics, can you just tell us a little bit about what are you training for in terms of specific competitions? Is it all throughout every year?
Okay, so with the different sports, there's different sports seasons. And for volleyball, the season just now changed. So next year it'll be during the fall, which will be nice back during the time when they're school. So it's easier to recruit kids and get kids to play. So we practice, and then we have area games, and then we also have regional games. And if you win at regionals, then you move on to the state games, which they really have fun because they play at ESPN. They get to stay the night. So they work, I would say, for about 3 months at least with practicing. And a lot of them practice on their own. They'll go to rec league volleyballs. They'll go to open gyms at different places. So they're very, very dedicated.
When you and I first started talking about why you wanted to get into coaching, you mentioned that it sounded like a great idea, but you kind of had no idea what you were doing. So can you talk to me about what kind of support or training does Special Olympics Florida provide to maybe someone like you who's interested but doesn't really know where to start?
Back in the beginning when I had no clue, Charlotte Day and Laura Szymaniski, they took me under their wing and they showed me everything. So they got uniforms for me. They got equipment for me. They helped me figure out the paperwork aspect. And they were just so supportive when it came to the basic needs and gave me a lot of information. They also have training courses that you can go to because you need to be a certified coach. So they do have lots of training for you, but Special Olympics is really good about giving their coaches and volunteers opportunities to learn and to grow and learn about the program.
There's a push to bring in this next generation of coaches. What would you say to our audience listening who may be thinking about it?
That definitely volunteer whatever sport that you like to do. Or even if you don't know anything about it, I would definitely volunteer and see what it's like. Because once you get to meet the kids and the athletes that are playing, you'll fall in love with it. The parents are just so appreciative of your time, and the athletes
absolutely love you because they're having fun and getting to be with other kids and learn a sport. So it's just a really, really good situation that they definitely need to give it a try. Even if, like I said, it's just volunteering to come to practice every now and then, but they would really like it. It's very rewarding.
In talking to you, it's very clear to me how much Jacob means to you, you mean to each other. How has being a Special Olympics coach changed you?
That is a really good question. I mean, I've always been real sensitive to people's needs. I do have an older sister that is special needs, and so I have been sensitive to that, but it just has made me a much better person. I'm a retired PE teacher. I taught for 37 years, and now I'm still coaching Special Olympics, and I look forward to getting to go and to see them when they practice, see them when they compete, but it's just made me a better person.
Jacob, will you talk to me about what do you love about Special Olympics Florida?
One thing I love about Special Olympics Florida is the camaraderie. Always being able to go to certain places, compete at the sports I love to do.
How does your coach make you feel both on the field and off the field?
I always know I can go to her. I mean, at any time, and then I can talk to her.
And Jacob, you told me you do, what, at least 10 sports? What's your advice to someone who thinks that they may want to try one of these sports as an athlete?
Give it a try. Just always have an open mind. I mean, I'm not the best at what I do, but I give it a college try.
And any advice to someone who might be thinking about becoming a coach, Jacob?
Like I said before, just go with an open mind. Be ready to learn. Accept advice.
There are different levels with Special Olympics. And so even if you're like a student or a young adult and you don't really know a lot about volleyball or softball or track and field, when you come in, the coaches take you at the level that you're at. And so like Division Four would be like the beginners, and they'll teach you, because we have kids that have never played volleyball or basketball, and they'll come in and go, yeah, I want to try that. And so the coaches will meet you where you are, and there'll be a team for you. So like Jacob's team, he's a D1 team. The volleyball team is D1. So they're really, really good. But we also have D4 teams where the kids are just beginning. And so the coaches adapt to that. And the coaches teach you how to do the sport. So I would encourage them to, you know, please try it. Check on the website, see what's offered. They'll send out notices so you can pick a sport that you want and also an area that's close to where you live. And so they're very, very accommodating, trying to include everyone.
That was Special Olympics Florida coach Wilma Wright and athlete Jacob Kraft. Coming up, the winner of the UCF Meowing Contest is next. You are listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. Don't forget to subscribe to the Engage podcasts on Apple Podcasts or Spotify so you don't miss an episode. Engage is available on demand anytime at cfpublic.org.
The Wrap is a podcast from Central Florida Public Media, curating the top Central Florida news stories and in-depth reporting each week. Join me, Brendan Byrne, as I bring you news headlines, deep reporting dives, and insightful conversations from the news team. A new episode of The Wrap every Friday morning. Get it wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Sharon Stone. It began with an Instagram post 2 weeks ago.
Anyone in Orlando down to meow? On Tuesday, October 14th, I'm hosting the world's first meowing contest. This is happening on Memory Mall at the UCF campus, and it's going to be huge. After one,
a meowing contest. Not of cats, but of humans. Full disclosure, we here on the Engage staff are cat lovers. Producer Richard Copeland has a calico named Moneypenny. Our director of audio content, Brad Waldo, has a cat named Betsy. And I have a pair of fur babies myself named Maggie and Mopar. You can imagine the excitement in our newsroom when this contest was announced. Richard went to the campus with UCF intern Orion Boone to witness this awesome display of talent.
At 1 p.m. on a sunny yet cool Tuesday, about 100 students gathered at a stone amphitheater directly next to UCF's Edition Arena. Three people sat at a table set in the middle of the stage. A singular mic stand and a small PA speaker were placed at the front. This is UCF Kitty's meowing contest.
The first round, you get one meow, a single meow, only one. If you do more, I don't know, you're disqualified, I guess. The second round, you get to freestyle. You can meow, you can purr, you can hiss. I don't really care. That's pretty much it.
That voice belongs to a man calling himself UCF Kitty. He's wearing a full head mask of a cat. At this point, his real identity is a secret, but he has promised to reveal himself. We'll get to that shortly. After parsing out the rules of the contest and presenting the first place prize, a 5-pound bag of Meow Mix, the contestants begin to step up to the mic.
I'm Nadezhda Alhova. Meow. Hey, everybody.
Meow. Hi, guys. Shout out to my lovely girlfriend for these awesome ears. Anyways.
Meow.
Hi guys, my name is Victoria. I've been waiting my whole life for this.
There was a lot of meowing and a lot of cheering, but this crowd didn't let any slackers through. There were a lot of boos.
Hello.
So why was this happening? Somewhere between the harmless adolescent fun and the theater of the absurd lurks UCF Kitty, the organizer and MC.
I have been trying to pursue content creation, so a lot of my ideas just come to me randomly throughout the day, and I completely lose track of where the actual idea originates from.
At the conclusion of the meowing contest, UCF Kitty revealed himself to be Liam Ryan, a former UCF student who graduated this past spring. Ironically, Liam is not a cat owner. In fact, he's allergic. He did all of this to gin up an Instagram following, and it worked. In 2 months, he grew his following from zero to over 10,000.
The response in the lead up was honestly great. I built quite the cult-like following in only 2 months, which was pretty crazy. I mean, that was the goal, and it worked out. A lot of students were, I guess, sympathizing with UCF Kitty's takes on the problems around campus, and I think the character kind of gave a voice to the masses, and the students appreciated that.
And where does UCF Kitty want to take this account now that he's established a brand?
Do it for the plot is what I like to say. So doing like stupid, absurd ideas, taking them way out of proportion until they actually have a meaningful impact in some way.
Back on campus, after 3 rounds and about 2 hours, the contest became heated. The meowing turned political, with students voicing both outrage at ICE and support for MAGA. Both responded to with cheers and boos. Ultimately, the crowd, which had swelled to over 400, found unity in melding meowing with an expression of patriotism. Keeping in mind that this is, in fact, a contest with a 5-pound bag of cat chow at stake, one had to wonder how a winner would be selected.
I'm not going to lie, it was completely subjective. We didn't even have a rubric or criteria. It was completely based off of vibes alone. So if my judges had any bias towards anybody, there was no precaution to avoid that.
But in the end, it was one committed competitor who took home the grand prize.
Hi, my name's Aitana. I dedicate this to my cat, Roasted Duck.
That was producer Richard Copeland and intern Orion Boone on the UCF campus.
Black and orange stray cat sitting on a fence. Ain't got enough dough to pay the rent.
We always want to hear from you and appreciate it when you reach out, like listener Tina McIntyre, who used the free Central Florida Public Media app to record a talkback message about a previous episode of Engage, where we talked about state of Florida DOGE cuts and property taxes.
Yeah, so I just wanted to add two aspects to that talk on the property tax with the Florida Tax Watch. You know, basically, we've had so many people moving in from other areas, which has raised the cost of living, raised the amount of roads, schools, everything. But, you know, it's also a power grab, number two, from the state, that basically it funds our local democracy. It runs our local representation. So we're paying local commissioners. Those dollars are going to local people and being decided locally, where if they defund property taxes, they're defunding local democracy and putting it up into the hands of the state revenue tax or the state, you know, different various state taxes, which is a huge power grab from the Republican Party who is currently in power. And I support democracy. I support local democracy. We are, you know, really seeing a consolidation of power, and not just in from the voting aspect and the redistricting stuff nationwide, but specifically monetary power being redistributed. If they get rid of the local tax, it's going to go to the state, and the state can decide what they want to do with that power.
Thank you for that comment. You can send us a talkback or send an email to engage@cfpublic.org to reach us. That's all for today's edition of Engage. I'm Sharon Stone. Thank you for the company. I just want to let you know that I'm going to be out for a few weeks, but I will be back in early December. Engage will still be here every week. All Things Considered is coming up right after NPR News.